The content here is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice. Please consult a healthcare professional with any medical questions and concerns.
If you are experiencing an emergency or need immediate help, call 911. In no way does listening, reading, emailing, or interacting on social media with our content establish a therapeutic relationship.
This episode contains discussions of trauma. Listener discretion is advised, and please take care of yourself while listening.
I just get so angry. It's hard to sit still. I don't want to be this way.
My brain just feels all scrambled.
Nikki, the other day I'm at a local Jimmy John's sandwich shop and I'm reading the sign and it's basically the words are all out of order except for the first and the last, and you can read it. And the gist of it is like the brain is such a wonderful thing, isn't it? Because all the letters don't have to be in order for you to understand it. What a wonderful thing. And I'm going, the brain is a wonderful thing, but if you've had something traumatic happen to you, it can be a scary, horrendous type of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the brain and the ways that it tries to protect you and, you know, keep you safe from things, it can actually sort of cause some problems down the line. And so we've been talking about trauma in the last mm-hmm. several episodes. And so I'm excited to continue that conversation today.
Yeah, and this is episode 67, how trauma shows up in children. And we kind of just wanted to show parents and caregivers and other adults around children what things to look for that could be signs of trauma in that child. And we bring on a special guest with us, and it's our first returning guest, and that's Dr. Jessica Patel.
Yes, Jessica's here, and she is a child clinical psychologist. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. And also, I have a master's of jurisprudence in child law, so I have a lot of background in trauma, and actually much of my work early on in my career was with trauma and foster care specifically.
Okay. So, well, that kind of marries things together. But when you talk about trauma in children, and we did the episode about trauma 101 and how it's kind of all relative and what's traumatic to me might not be traumatic to you and stuff. But when you're dealing with, I'll use the air quotes you can't see, but like legitimate trauma, something that's just been very traumatic from even before birth, how does that stuff start to kind of manifest when the child gets a little older?
That's a great question because it is so different for everyone. Mm. So I think that's a really generic answer. But
I knew you were going to say that.
Not a one-size-fits-all approach, just like kind of everything with psychology and your brain as well. Yeah. And so I think when we think about trauma, you know, we will think about some of the characteristics and how they can manifest. And, you know, you'll hear people talk about like freeze, fight, or flight. Mm-hmm. And then also like what we now call like the fawn response. And just kind of thinking about how that looks in kids. And of course, that's going to be different depending on when the trauma occurred and the age and what other factors kind of come into play for them. But if we're thinking about like just thinking, breaking that down. So thinking about freezing, for example. So that could be something where you're trying to talk to a child and they have a lot of trouble responding. And sometimes it's what we would consider as adults, like simple things, like what do you want for dinner or what kind of pizza toppings do you like? But it can be very hard for them sometimes to even respond in some of those ways. Or when they're put on the spot, some of that can come out. So it's literally can be freezing what they're doing or pausing or maybe even seeming confused at times. If we think about, and I want to talk about fawn and then I'll go to the other ones, like the fawning response, which often will lead people to thinking that everything's okay with the kid because they're just so agreeable. So whatever you want is totally fine. Like that might be a response and not really being able to make some of those decisions for themselves. And they're really, really trying to please other people to keep them happy, you know, because of that experience of trauma. And the ones, and those tend to be kind of more internal and sometimes don't get picked up on quite as much. Mm-hmm. But then if we think about like the flight or fight, that is what oftentimes will get kids into our clinic a little bit faster. So if we're thinking about flight, this could be things like for anything from a kid literally like running out of school or running out of an office or running out of the house. It could be them, you know, running out of the room and going to hide somewhere. It could present in a lot of different ways. But of course, that's a more external or noticeable behavior that usually people will want to start to intervene with or people will kind of start to talk about safety planning. And then fight is usually what will get people in the fastest is when literally kids look like they're fighting for their lives and can put up a fight. And there isn't always what we would see externally as a noticeable trigger. It doesn't mean there isn't a trigger. We just might not know what it is. And that could be verbally, like fighting, arguing, lashing out, or it could actually get physical to the point where other people have to leave the room or there are safety concerns involved as well. So as I said, based on age and environment and kind of what they're experiencing, it can look very different in individuals and also in any given moment as well. So sometimes people kind of cycle through all of these things.
So there, like you said, was a lot to it. It's not a one size fits all, but at what point, and I'm thinking like a teacher, but I guess a parent too, if they see a child acting out in class, whether they're kicking chairs or punching the wall or, you know, heaven forbid, another kid or something, or kicking the teacher, I know that happens too, versus someone who's just like so shy that they won't speak, at what point do they go, okay, maybe there is something deeper here and this isn't just a child making bad decisions?
Yeah, I think all behavior, whether it's adults or kids, communicates something. And everyone who has the capacity to do well, really, like, we're all good humans. You know, kids are great, adults are great. We all are really good inside. And that's kind of something to remember. So when there's something external happening, or they don't look like themselves, or there are these what we would call like, quote unquote, like bad behaviors, we have to look at where is that coming from? Like, most kids are not going to school and saying like, hey, I want to kick my teacher today. Or hey, I want to be really disruptive with my classmates or disrupt my friendships. It's that they literally in those moments cannot control and self-regulate. And so it's looking at, and I think this is really hard for everyone to do, is you have to pause. And whenever you see those kind of behaviors or actions, is thinking like, where is this coming from? And what is a child trying to communicate in these moments? And that is really, really critical, because otherwise, which we can also talk about, kids will get mislabeled as like bad kids, and there are no bad kids. Like, that really is something that is kind of triggering to me as a psychologist. Yeah. Or, you know, looking at the behavior from a totally inaccurate lens that then leads to mislabeling of the child and people viewing them in a very negative way. And a lot of times they're having responses that, if you think about it, you know, we don't want to excuse any behavior, of course. We want to address it and make sure everyone's safe and doing well. But, you know, sometimes with the cases I've worked with, it's like, wow, if I put myself in the position of that child, like knowing what they went through with especially some of the bigger traumas, I can't guarantee I wouldn't be acting in that exact same way, right, or that most people wouldn't. And so really having that kind of understanding about where it's coming from, so that way we can appropriately address it.
So that's going to be very tricky for parents, because parents see their kids at their best and they see their kids at their worst. So on one hand, I'm going, they're probably the first to notice there might be something deeper. But then I'm also going, they're probably the first to step in and try to use a discipline approach instead of trying to dig deeper and find that. And third, that just popped into my head, you would think the parent would know about the trauma, but not necessarily.
All good points. And so, you know, just to address the trauma piece, like, sometimes parents will know about traumas and sometimes they don't, which is a very, you know, I have my own kids, as I've talked about, I have four of my own kids, which is a terrifying thing to think of as a parent. The other assumption well, no, it can be terrifying sometimes. Yeah. No, they're wonderful, wonderful kids. But like thinking that there's something going on with your kids that's really significant that you don't know about, like, that's scary. And that actually can be something that parents, you know, think about quite a bit, you know, from everything when like they're starting a new daycare or a new school or what's happening. If they go to someone's house, like, that could be very, you know, just something that is kind of scary to think about as a parent, but there might be something going on that you are not aware of. Another assumption is, and I hate to say this, is that, you know, not everyone have parents that are willing or able to acknowledge the trauma. And sometimes the parents are going through trauma, or the parents are not responding to the trauma or not believing the trauma, which of course is a whole nother piece that's going on too. And also, like, there's can be a difference between, you know, more of like an acute trauma, like something that just happened and is done. It could be also something from the past that the parent maybe sometimes thought was done. They're like, we thought we moved past this, like, it's been so long. Or we also have to think about people who are having ongoing trauma. And I know that you were talking about, you know, discussing like in the future, like treatment for trauma or things like that. And really, if the child is in a situation where there's ongoing trauma, that can be very difficult. And those could be the big traumas we think about in terms of, you know, abuse or neglect or things like that that are happening. It can also be like the smaller traumas, like they'll talk about, you know, like the adverse childhood experiences or the ACEs that kids can experience that still can impact you in a traumatic way and have really long-term negative effects.
So there's got to be a very thin line, a big gray area between figuring out if there's some trauma in this kiddo's past versus an anxiety disorder or ADHD. I mean, a lot of these symptoms are all kind of lapping over each other.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's been a lot of research on kids who have experienced trauma also and misdiagnoses of ADHD because there's so much overlap with some of the symptoms. So if you think about, you know, just you can have no background in psychology, but if you think about if something really bad happened to you, are you going to be able to focus? Not usually. Like you're thinking about other things or you're focused on the trauma. Or sometimes kids have to be very, very hypervigilant because that's kind of, they have to protect themselves. And if you have to worry about these other things, no, you can't sit there and focus on your math lesson. You can be very distractible. You might talk more tangentially about things or kind of miss parts of conversation. You might have more difficulty with sleep or work or school. You can also be much more irritable, just like any of us can be when we're experiencing something too. And so there has been a lot of research on trauma and kids being completely misdiagnosed with ADHD. And kids who enter foster care, for example, are over 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. Oh. And it does not mean that you can, you know, of course, there are kids, children in foster care who also would be criteria for ADHD and pretty stably would. But, you know, that overlap of symptoms and then how to treat that is totally different. If you're thinking about ADHD versus trauma in terms of like medication or therapy, all of the approaches are completely different. So there can be a lot of kind of confounding factors there as well.
So what would be the first step for a parent or another adult if they hear this episode and they go, you know what, my kid's been doing this for the last few months. Maybe there has been something traumatic. What's the first step that adult has to take?
That's a really tricky question. And one of the reasons is say that, and I'll have this happen to just in practice, is when there is a major shift in behavior that sometimes parents will make the assumption that there's a trauma. And that is scary. And as a psychologist, or if you talk to any mental health professional, you know, we can, of course, always have open-ended conversations with kids and kind of ask them in general about things that they've experienced. But there was also a lot of, I don't know what the right word is here, but a lot of, I'll say stuff because that's a great word, a lot of things going on in like the early 90s where there are actually a lot of false memories and things like that that were coming up for kids that led to like these major cases where, for example, there was a daycare provider in one of the southern states who was charged with like multiple counts of child abuse based on false allegations. And so, and that was directly due to improper questioning about trauma. So even myself, as a psychologist with a ton of experience and background in trauma, if a child is making like a new disclosure of trauma, or if I'm suspecting trauma, I would keep like very, very open-ended questions and then stop. And then I would refer it to someone who is a specialist in forensic interviewing because of how muddy those waters can be. So if we're talking about major traumas, that can get really, really tricky.
Speaking of muddy waters, false memories, holy cow.
Yes.
So because of the line of questioning, they start to remember things differently than actually how they happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's terrifying.
And it is terrifying. And there were multiple lawsuits in the, it was in the 1990s, this happened quite a bit, or not quite a bit, but there were, I shouldn't say that. There were too many times where there were major, major, major cases. And sometimes, you know, some of these cases could have spawned from a child genuinely reporting a trauma. And then the way that subsequent kids were being questioned by their parents, by like, again, everyone's well-meaning when they're interviewing kids, that could lead to false memories and other kids and false reports. And I actually had even heard the audio of some of these interviews. Wow. And they were very, very, very disturbing and leading, and just in terms of the questions they're asked. So you do have to do like a very kind of open-ended questions and kind of tap dancing around. You want to make sure you're not like, oh, your teacher hurt you, didn't they? Or something like that. Like that is very, yes, and no leading questions. But if you're like, oh, tell me what happened, and you're keeping it very open-ended. And then when it gets to the point where like, I have all the information I can, if it is something that would involve the authorities, then you kind of move on to the next step. And of course, these are, you know, the big traumas. And then I know you've also talked about in the episodes regarding trauma, there's, you know, quote unquote, and we don't want to minimize anything, like, you know, what we would call like the little T's, like the smaller traumas that more people experience. And those could be things like the adverse childhood experiences. Those could be things, you know, like parental divorce, which we don't think of as a trauma because it happens to so many people, but it does drastically impact kids.
Sure.
And so just thinking about all of these different like levels of things that can happen as well.
Jessica, what advice would you have for parents if they believe something has happened to their child, but they don't have any facts? We get that a lot. Like people will call, Oh my gosh, my child just reported, or so-and-so just said that this thing happened. I want to get them in right away. I want to get them into therapy right away. And oftentimes as a mental health professional, I'm like, well, that may not be the first step. Like there's other things that need to happen if there's, you know, a potential trauma, or especially if it's abuse, that kind of thing. What advice would you have for someone who's just discovered something has happened?
Yeah. And if it's something that would be at the level of a mandated report, like a psychologist, I'm a mandated reporter. Anyone in any state who's working with kids, with very few exceptions, are mandated reporters, then kind of talking about, okay, who do we make this report to? And then how are they going to collect the information? And in most places, they have children's advocacy centers that then step in a very non-threatening way, will do interviews, forensic interviews with kids, and are very, very highly trained. And so that would kind of be the first step. Mm-hmm. And then once they've kind of like data collected and kind of figured out what is going on to the best extent they can, because again, you know, we can't, you know, magically get this information. Sometimes we'll never have enough to kind of fully go off and understand what happened. But at least like once that part has happened, then, you know, entering into therapy or something like that with someone who has a lot of experience in trauma is really, really, really important. You know, there are some great therapists who are more generalists, but trauma really does take more of a specialized lens depending on, you know, when it happened and things like that and what ages you're working with too.
It's a good point with the ages, because if you have something, and we talked in the Trauma 101 episode that babies can get traumatized in the womb, so they can literally be born into trauma, versus someone who's older, a teenager, even a young adult who's has something traumatic happen and they witness something horrific, they're in a car crash or something. So how does it play differently in babies to even kids that are more verbal?
Again, it's going to look different at anyone. I would say, especially with younger kids, it can be hard to differentiate between like, quote unquote, like typical little kid dysregulation mm-hmm. at times. Mm-hmm. Although oftentimes if it is more of that dysregulation piece, it can be more extreme. It's also harder with younger kids because, you know, their personalities really aren't formed yet. So, you know, there's so much change going on at that stage. So it's hard to tell, like, are they just going through a phase where they are being more shy or more clingy to mom or dad, or, you know, don't want to go to school? Or are they just like, you know, kind of having more tantrums? Or is this related to trauma? And it can be really hard to pull those things apart. When the kids 8, for example, if they're experiencing like an acute trauma and something happens, usually you're going to notice if it's more of those externalizing behaviors a little bit faster, but it just really depends. And some people really mask their experiences and their feelings surrounding trauma. And again, this can happen for anyone, but especially if there's any sense of insecurity in terms of the level of support you have, you know, from family or teachers. And again, it's perceived support. So they could actually have a very, very great support sure. system, but how do they perceive that support? And do they feel safe? And do they have that really solid foundation? That's going to impact kind of the manifestation of a lot of those symptoms as well. I think one of the things to remember is, I would never assume just because a child has a major change in behavior that there has been some sort of trauma without any sort of evidence. Now, of course, there are things that the kid could be doing. I've seen kids who have definitely been exposed to things that they should know exist. Mm-hmm. And when they're talking about these things or they're playing them out in their play, then you might make an assumption that there's some sort of trauma, and that might be correct. But we do get calls, or I'll get calls about kids where there's been some sort of behavioral shift and the assumption is trauma, but there's no kind of like evidence for that. And I'll even talk to parents about like kind of trusting your spidey sense. Well, maybe we don't know something, but was there ever a time when you like really just had this really bad feeling in your gut and that something was going on? And now that you're reflecting on it, maybe, you know, you can see something a little bit differently. But a lot of times there aren't those things, and kids can also manifest some of these differences without any sort of history of trauma.
Jessica, you mentioned the support system. And so let's say you have, you know, 10 adults at a support system. How detrimental can it be if you have one person in that support system who's not supportive or doesn't buy into the trauma?
If they are, I would say, you know, there's kind of different levels of that kind of rejection. So, you know, some people, are they not supportive in the sense of maybe they don't recognize the trauma or don't want to talk about the trauma or avoidant of the trauma, which is still not great. Or there are people who actively deny that the person experienced a trauma, or are completely minimizing the trauma. And sometimes that comes from a place where, you know, just if we're thinking kind of psychologically, where either they don't want to believe that. So it's not even sometimes that ill intent behind it, although it definitely comes off that way because they're like, that is so horrific. I can't imagine that that would have happened, or that I sometimes, you know, sometimes people are at fault. Like, I put them in that situation, or I brought this person into the home and they feel that they are really responsible. Or sometimes they experience their own trauma. And it kind of, you know, if you're coming from a household that didn't have trauma, some people don't realize that that's not the norm, you know. And I've worked in many facets of mental health treatment, but at one point in time, I was actually working in a center that was a partial day program for women who had lost their kids into the foster care system because they had experiencing substance abuse. And it was a very nice program because they're reuniting the families and the kids were involved in everything else. 100% of the women in there experienced trauma. Most of them did not realize that most people do not experience trauma. So that kind of schematic that you're coming from can also totally shift how you view things. This can also how much you even hear about trauma. So as a person who's done, you know, trauma-focused therapy in the past and has a lot of experience in working with people who experience trauma, I hate to say it, but there's not much that people can tell me that can surprise me. Yeah. It saddens me. Yeah. And I have like, I never want that to happen to anyone, but it's not surprising. And I hate to say that. But there are people who have never, you know, experienced trauma, witnessed trauma, heard about trauma, and they can kind of start to experience that vicarious trauma themselves just from hearing about it and then kind of want to remove themselves from the situation.
And then I would imagine to the person who experienced the trauma, that could be another traumatic event. If you have one person in your so-called support system who's just not giving you the support that you need, then that's just going to pile on top of it.
Yeah. And some people, I was going to say too, and some people don't, and this is so sad to think about, but I'm going to say it because I think it's important. Some kids have no support system, none, even at very young ages. And so then you can imagine how they're processing the trauma and, you know, how that might manifest. And that is a really, you know, kind of sad component to think about as well.
And it kind of speaks to we talked a little bit about like complex trauma. You know, if you've got a situation where a child has been abused or experienced something and then their primary care person doesn't believe them and is discounting and minimizing, it's like a double layer of trauma to work through because now the person that's supposed to keep them safe and protect them is sort of abandoning and turning their eye on something that was really horrible.
Well, and we talked about kind of like false memories that can come up. And that actually has led to a lot of people like discounting people's memories of trauma or how they're reporting trauma. And many, many people, especially children, but just people in general, when they're continuously questioned about what happened and the details, just because of the way their brain works and processes trauma, they'll give different details or some of the details may shift. And the moment something slightly shifts, if there is someone who's suspicious of the trauma, they will absolutely jump on that. Yep. And so then that can lead other people to discounting the trauma. And even more than that, there's a significant amount of kids, and some researchers said up to 25% of kids who will then recant their trauma and say it never happened. And a lot of times this is because the kid goes to a trusted adult, and that could be a very loving adult, like a teacher who they have a great relationship with. A teacher is a mandated reporter. So then what happens if like Child Protective Services get involved and that leads to removing the child from their family for safety, a significant amount of kids in that situation, you know, would rather be back in that familiar home, even if there was that trauma, because they're used to it and they know what to expect. And they might be separated from their siblings. And in those situations, sometimes they'll recant the trauma, but that'll lead, you know, kind of the doubters to say, okay, well, then it never happened. And then you can think of what that does with mental health and manifestations of trauma and everything else too.
Can you, I don't know if this is like a Hollywood thing that I've seen in the movie or if it's legit, but can you suppress trauma so much so that something years down the road, whether you are subjected to a trigger that populates it back to the forefront of your mind, or if you're in a therapy session and they kind of dig a little deeper and then all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, this happened to me as a child and I didn't even know about it. Does that make sense?
That's a really good question. I think there's a lot of controversy around kind of suppressed memories. Like, I definitely think that it would be possible. Usually there's some sort of recollection though of something happening, and then maybe remembering more details later on. The problem is that there's no kind of proof of if it's a true memory or not. Right. And I would be much more suspicious depending on therapeutic strategies that are used to kind of quote unquote retrieve memories that were suppressed in some way. Because again, going back to like all everything that was happening, especially in like the 90s with all of these court cases, these were truly like memories that could, things that could not have happened. These were things like my teacher took me out on a boat and they threw us into the ocean and we had to swim with sharks. And that was scary. It's like, well, that couldn't have happened, yeah. You know, like that you would know if that happened. And, but it was so then real to the child and real to the other people. And so we really don't then have proof of like what did or did not happen. So it can get very, very, very tricky. But I also think there was a lot because of Hollywood people kind of walking around like, do I have some sort of right. like repressed memory that I'm not sure about? Like that would not be of concern to me just as a human. But again, there could be some sort of like trauma and some memory that then triggers more. Or again, what I see a lot of times is people not realizing that something was a trauma because it was normalized in their own childhood experience.
That makes sense. That makes sense. This whole thing of false memories is like very troubling. It's going to keep me awake at night.
I'll get you some data and we can do a whole episode on false memories and debunking false memories.
Awesome. What I'm hearing, Dr. Patel, is that like ultimately, if a child has a change in behavior or has a troubling behavior or something that you see as a parent or adult in their life, trauma is one thing we should consider. Even if something has happened, obviously we may know that, but if we don't know, it's something to keep in mind, but we shouldn't assume that's what it is because there are a lot of different causes of those behaviors. Is that kind of it?
And I also think too, just again, and I know you've addressed this too, is how we're thinking about trauma. So it may not be some sort of major trauma, but maybe it's another stressor in the environment. Mm-hmm. And of course, we would think about those in just a little bit different way too.
And the good news out of all of this is there are ways to treat trauma and there are several different ways, just as if there are several different types of trauma you can get. So we're going to hold on to Dr. Patel for our next episode that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks, episode 68. And we're talking about how to treat trauma. So we appreciate you listening. We appreciate you liking and sharing these episodes. If you want to give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts, we're not going to, you know, turn that away. Our whole goal in starting this podcast was to start a conversation, and that conversation continues with you.